Welcome to TWT FM, a podcast from The World Transformed, an annual festival and year-round political education project committed to delivering political education across the UK in order to build a movement capable of radically transforming society.
We'll be releasing weekly podcasts across September to coincide with this year's festival, looking at the big topics with a wide-angle lens you'd expect from TWT.
You can now register for a festival pass and view the full September programme at theworldtransformed.org.
But for now, turn up your headphones, sit back and listen up. This is The World Transformed.
When we started planning these shows, we chose topics we thought resonated with life during coronavirus, but could also be expanded far beyond the pandemic. Given the economic precarity of the situation, debt seemed an obvious choice. But more than that, debt is a concept central to the disciplinary systems of control that capitalism exerts on us, a power relation used to entrench inequality. This is just one of the many concepts expressed brilliantly by anthropologist and activist Professor David Graeber, who sadly died on the 2nd of September. This loss has been keenly felt by many activists from The World Transformed and elsewhere, who experienced David's charm and encouragement. As you will hear, his arguments reverberate through many of the people who contributed to this episode. Accordingly, we dedicate this show to the memory of David Graeber. To begin with, we spoke to Sarah Jane Clifton, Director of Jubilee Debt Campaign, a UK-based charity focused on the connections between poverty and debt, and who helped us in putting this episode together.
So in this highly financialised economy that's structured by mass levels of debt, how do you think that's kind of shaped the way that we navigate our everyday lives?
So one of the most important things to understand about debt is that it doesn't affect all people equally. How you're affected by debt varies really dramatically depending on who you are. So one of the most important theories of debt, an Italian philosopher and sociologist, a guy called Maurizio Lazzarato, he describes debt as an engine of the politics of neoliberalism. And basically what this means is it's one of the key mechanisms which drives growing inequalities of wealth and power in the global economy. Generally, for working people in the UK, even though we live in the sixth richest country in the world per capita, over the last 40 years, we've seen growing numbers of people needing to resort to borrowing in order to cover basic needs like food, rent, utility bills, and also to cover services that previously the state would provide and which were universal. So there's obviously a big push to increase the number of services that we have to pay for and therefore that we would have to get into debt from potentially. For example, lots of people in the Conservative Party are wanting to see the introduction of a healthcare system like they have in the US, where everyone has to get private healthcare insurance. And if you can't afford it or the insurance doesn't cover what you need, then you have to borrow money to access healthcare. And we're already seeing this in the UK with people who, because of the racist nature of our state structures, are being denied citizenship rights and therefore basic human rights. For example, the Windrush generation, migrants with no recourse to public funds, being locked out of the NHS and having to get into tens of thousands of pounds worth of debt to cover healthcare treatment. So basically, governments are operating, that are operating with neoliberal policies, have torn up the welfare state and they've crushed the trade unions. And debt has become the safety net of last resort for people when they can't make ends meet on low wages or they lose their jobs. Debt extracts wealth from poor people and perpetuates poverty through the charging of exorbitant interest rates. For example, here in the UK, there's currently no cap on the interest rates that the banks and lenders can charge, except for there is a cap now on payday loans, and there's also a cap on rent to own, which are two of the most kind of exploitative forms of credit. Those caps were won by campaigners, but there's no kind of equivalent cap for credit cards, loans, mortgages, other types of debt. The reason this is a problem, the Bank of England sets what's called the base rate, which is basically the interest rate that the banks and the lenders are charged when they borrow from the Bank of England. So the interest rate that the lenders have to pay in order to get the money in the first place, that's set by the Bank of England. And it's actually been falling since 2008 because we've had this super lax monetary policy since 2008 where the Bank of England has been keeping interest rates incredibly low. But once they've got the money, they can charge what they like for it, with the exception, like I said, of payday loans and rent-to-own products. And then what we see is there's basically a poverty premium, what's called a poverty premium for access to credit. So the more poor you are, the more high risk you're considered, and the more the lenders have a justification to charge you exorbitant interest rates. So you can see this process whereby the poorer you are, the more you have to pay to access credit, and the more wealth is extracted from you. And there's obviously beneficiaries of that system, which are the banks and the lenders and their shareholders. If you're relatively rich, on the other hand, debt is pretty innocuous. It doesn't have such an impact on you. You still might need to borrow to make big investments, for example, in property. But if you're rich, you'll be able to access very low interest rates because you'll be considered low risk. And then what you pay in interest will be more than covered by the money you'll make from your investment, probably. So debt extracts wealth disproportionately from people who are poor and on low incomes. That's what happens at the kind of personal and individual level. There's a parallel process which is happening at the national level in the global economy, where we see a really important role for debt basically in extracting wealth from poor countries in the global south and perpetuating the major inequalities in wealth and in power that we see in the global economy, which were put in place by colonialism. Because the basic kind of systems of wealth extraction that were put in place under colonialism are still kind of operating. For poor countries, for example, they spend about nearly $3 billion a month on debt repayments. And that's debt which is then repaid either to rich countries like the US, Japan, Germany, and France, or repaid to the private sector, which tends to be based in rich countries. So banks and lenders like those based in the City of London, or to the IMF and World Bank, which are these big global financial institutions, which are controlled by rich countries. So it's very, very obvious who the winners and losers are from this system.
You've outlined really the different ways that debt becomes like a disciplinary function of capitalism, a system of kind of immense reliance, and I suppose to some extent almost a system that we've become quite numb to because it's so prevalent. So I was just wondering, like, if you can maybe talk a little bit more about that.
We tend to think of there being sort of two types of power that debt is able to instrumentalize in order to have the effect that it does in the economy. It has a moral power, and then it also has a very sort of harsh economic power. On the moral side, you can really see it operating, for example, in all of the tabloid coverage of people with debt problems. There's been a bit of a turn, actually, in the last couple of years of the tabloid coverage with, I think, increasing sympathy with people who have personal debt problems. But up until a couple of years ago, the narrative was very much one around shame. People who were in debt were considered to be lazy, to be failures, just to have not really succeeded in being kind of Thatcher's modern economic man. And that guilt and shame, really, it prevents people from getting help with their debt. It keeps people stuck in a debt trap, stops people from talking to each other about their debt, and everybody from realizing how common a problem this is, how it's affecting so many people, how badly it's affecting so many people. So at that kind of personal, individual level, debt has an enormous moral power. And in order to kind of tackle and break the power of debt in helping to create this really unfair economic system, we need to tackle that moral power. Then, of course, there's the really hard economic power of debt. So that's really something which is which the credit ratings agencies have a really big role to play in, basically determining how credit worthy you are, either as a person or as a country. If you're not determined to be credit worthy enough because you're already in lots of debt, you don't have enough assets, you're not earning enough, then you're charged higher interest rates and you're increasingly exploited. And then On top of that, for example, lots of poor countries owe money to the IMF and World Bank. These are kind of global lenders of last resort. And in order to access IMF bailouts, you have to sign up to an IMF program. What used to be called structural adjustment programs now have slightly nicer names, but basically the IMF still pushes countries to cut public spending, cut public sector wages, increase taxes in ways which are regressive, basically requiring that from countries if countries are going to be able to access credit from the IMF.
Just bringing it back to kind of this moment of kind of multiple crises that are happening, I'm interested to know a little bit more about how debt thrives off these crises.
So there's different impacts at the sort of personal level and the national level. At the personal level, here in the UK, we've seen, well, coronavirus having a really polarizing impact on debt. So the credit reference agency Experian has released some research showing that people have been able to pay down nearly £16 billion worth of debt during the course of the pandemic. That's nearly £2,000 per person. Basically because for wealthier households whose incomes haven't been disrupted by coronavirus, the shutting down of the economy has meant that they haven't been able to spend money. You've had what's described as an almost kind of pent-up demand in the economy where people want to spend money, but they can't. And as a result, a lot of people have been very lucky and have actually been able to pay down quite a lot of debt. On the other hand, the debt advice agency Step Change has done research showing that 6 million adults have fallen behind on at least one household bill during the pandemic. Basically, people who were already economically vulnerable, on low wages, in precarious work, or people who have been negatively impacted, who have lost their jobs or face reduced hours because of coronavirus, have had to basically resort to taking on debt in order to cover for basic needs, in order to keep themselves afloat during coronavirus. So the pandemic is basically debt and the pandemic together further increased the kind of inequality that we see in the economy. At the level of countries, coronavirus is slightly different situation really, in the sense that coronavirus has been economically devastating for everybody. But again, the richer countries have had many more tools in their toolbox in order to be able to keep their economies afloat during this time. So we've seen enormous monetary financing by rich countries like the UK, Germany, France, and the US. Now, poorer countries don't have as many tools in their toolbox. One of the ways in which rich countries have managed to kind of keep their power in the global economy since colonialism is making sure that poor countries don't have access to the same tools. And as a result, we've seen poor countries facing multiple economic shocks because of coronavirus, a collapse in tourism, massive capital flight, at a time when they also need to be investing in more public services and not having the tools available to actually spend more money in order to do that.
I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons, a number 9 coal, and the straw boss said, well, bless my soul, you load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Over the last couple of months, the pubs have reopened, and with the latest lockdown rule changes, they may become one of the only places you can meet your friends. We all know the danger of a contentious political conversation when you've had one too many shandies, and the Tories are again implying the country needs to tighten its belt. So we've compiled these handy pub-ready answers to questions about the UK government's supposed debt problem.
You cannot go on living beyond your means year in and year out.
Is the UK living beyond its means?
The UK government isn't. The UK government doesn't have a debt problem, it has a debt opportunity. It can borrow at the lowest interest rates in its history, at hardly any interest at all. So it needs to use that opportunity to tackle many of the economic challenges we do face. Obviously, that includes things like access to housing and to energy, but also we have within the British economy, the private companies and households have got large amounts of debt, and it's those kinds of debts that caused the recession and crisis in 2008.
The situation I faced as Chancellor, which was a sort of emergency situation where the country had run out of money and we were facing, you know, a potential economic disaster.
But what about our massive interest bill?
The UK government at the moment is spending the lowest amount on interest payments that it has ever spent. So this is a complete contrast to what people like the Conservative government were telling people, that suddenly the interest bill was running out of control. That although the debt rose over the last 10 years, because the interest rate has gone down, the absolute amount being spent on interest is now at its lowest level ever. So the government is the furthest away from having a debt problem that it has ever been.
There isn't a magic money tree that we can shake that suddenly provides for everything that people want.
Does that mean that there is a magic money tree?
There is, always has been, a magic money tree in the UK. We've been using it ever since the financial crisis over a decade ago. It's the Bank of England creates money and uses that to buy government debt. And then the government effectively has to pay no interest on that debt and never has to repay it. So one third of UK government debt, $700 billion, effectively does not exist. So when people tell you something like the government owes $2 trillion, one third of that $700 billion doesn't really exist. It's not an unlimited magic money tree, but it is some form of magic money tree that can respond to crises. And the impact of that is that the government now can borrow at the lowest interest rates in its history. So the government can borrow at an interest rate of just 0.3% fixed for 10 years. Now, if you were a business or an individual with an idea of what you could invest money in, if you were able to borrow at that interest rate, you could go and invest it in lots of things that would enable you to be in a financially better position in the future. For instance, you might be able to buy a house rather than having to rent, and that would save you money. In the government's point of view, they could go and build public housing, which would mean they'd have to spend less money subsidising landlords through housing benefits. So the government can use the fact it can borrow so cheaply in order to save itself money in the future. And it's actually kicking itself in the face if it doesn't do that.
The more the government borrows, the more it has to repay. The more it has to repay, the more lenders worry about getting their money back. And the more lenders start to worry, the less confidence there is in our economy.
So where does the idea of balancing the books come from?
It comes from a political ideology that wants to shrink the state. So that was clearly seen after the 2010 general election, that then government interest rates were falling and the Conservative and Liberal Democrat government created this narrative that there was somehow this debt crisis. Now, I work for an organisation that does work on genuine debt crises. Across the world, we do see lots of governments that do get in problems with paying debts. That the feature of those is that they are paying debts outside of their country to people outside their country, often at high interest rates and often not in their own currency. With the UK government's debt, a third of it is owed to itself, to the Bank of England. Then much of the rest is owed to people within the UK, mainly things like pension funds. It's a way of saving. And just a small proportion, about a fifth, is owed to people outside the UK. So most of the payments on the debt stay within the country. And when you have a genuine debt crisis, most of the payments are leaving the country. Also, with the government's debt, it is owed in a currency that the government controls, the pound. Whereas governments that get into debt problems are often made to borrow in other people's currencies, which can cause them all sorts of problems. So the UK government just doesn't have any of these features around its debt that creates problems in other countries.
You heard me. Get him up, Pat.
Cheers to Tim Jones from Jubilee Debt Campaign. After those refreshing libations, we return our attention to Walthamstow in London and two artists with an ingenious community intervention to educate, empower, and in some cases eradicate debt in the local area.
Hello, I'm Hilary Powell, Governor of Hoe Street Central Bank.
And I'm Dan Edelstein, Head of Explosives at Hoe Street Central Bank.
And we're part of a bank job spanning quite a few years, involving opening a bank, printing money and exploding debt.
So the project kind of came out of the feeling of, you know, being a, I'm a filmmaker, and every month I felt that I was struggling to pay the basic bills by doing all sorts of totally meaningless work, which kept me really, really busy, but also kept me away from being able to enact any of the ideals which had brought me into art in the first place. I remember at the time I watched the Charlie Chaplin film Modern Times, where Chaplin becomes almost like a part of a machine. And I felt like that I felt like I was in some ways being subsumed within a system and becoming increasingly like a cog in a machine. And that wasn't just a situation for me, but it was a situation for millions of people up and down the country. So I felt I was being dragged increasingly towards a meaningless world and or a meaningless life. While I was feeling those things, I guess I started reading lots and lots of books. Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, George Orwell's Why I Write, Tolstoy wrote a book called A Confession. And sort of whilst I was grappling around looking for a sort of philosophical hold on the world, someone told me about Strike Debt, you know, the group in New York who were buying up and abolishing millions of dollars worth of student debt. Finding out about Strike Debt was a kind of spark which called me into action and took me into a story. And then from there, I read Graeber's book about debt, The First 5,000 Years. And basically, it sort of flipped almost every understanding that I'd had about economics and finance on its head. And before long, I was kind of infected by the sort of intelligence and criticism of a system which was clearly working in the favour of a very narrow group of elites.
We wanted to make a film as one vehicle and way of getting this idea out there. But then we were struggling with the way to tell that story because we're not, you know, we weren't going to write a big volume about debt. We couldn't translate that to the screen. But it was only when we started to get really involved in our community, kind of asking the question, I suppose from Andrew Ross's question, is London and is Walthamstow specifically where we live, our home, a creditocracy? And quickly finding that the answer was, yes, it is. You know, there's, you know, mass indebtedness. The local health trust, Barts, is indebted, you know, with massive private finance initiatives. The, you know, food bank usage is up. Our school is struggling in the local primary school. So we kind of began to enlist a team of people that we were talking to about it, but also getting involved in what became the bank job. If you're trying to talk about debt, it often seems kind of, oh my God, this is like very dull and deadpan. But when you turned it around to make it a bank job, and we're talking about money and its flip side, debt, suddenly it had this kind of infectious, kind of mischievous quality that we could get the community involved with. Bank job really became a proper bank job when we got the bank. And that just came from knowing that we wanted to replicate and kind of transfer to the UK what Strike Debt had done in America, buying up and destroying debt. So we were focusing on high interest, kind of predatory debt locally. But the way of doing that, Strike Debt had big fundraisers and music events. But we thought the kind of ideal way for us to do that would be to give ourselves the power of central banks, kind of take back control of the money supply and print our own money. But the money would be, instead of like featuring famous people from, you know, British history and the kind of this loaded symbolism that we hold in our pockets on the notes that we carry, we'd kind of feature people in our community that were really fighting the fallout of austerity and the debt-fueled economy. So we had Gary, who was running a local food bank, and Syra, who was running a homeless kitchen with her family, Tracy Griffiths, who was the head teacher of our children's primary school, and oh my God, Steve and Josh, who run the Soul Project, which was a young people's project in Walthamstow that had just lost their building. So they became the figures on the notes. We got this bank, which was an old co-op bank that had just been vacated on the high street. Like many, many buildings all around the country, high street banks are closing down and these spaces of opportunity are opening up. And we recruited a team of local people, all paid London Living Wage, to print the money. And we had no idea if it would work. Like, we knew that we wanted to raise £20,000 to be able to buy up £1.2 million of local high interest debt. But we wanted to raise £40,000 because we wanted to give half of the money from the sale of the banknotes to the debt write-off and half directly to those local community causes. So having that public, yeah, street-facing space where you could welcome people in that were just passing by and then get people talking, having a team of really committed money printers who also kind of, even by the act of being on the production line, they were learning and then sharing that learning, having this space where, you know, as alongside the money being printed and the smell of ink and the machines kind of churning out the notes, we had this kind of constant programme of events.
Okay, one thing that we always get asked is how does it work, this debt write-off? What's the mechanism for it? Basically, the secondary debt market exists so that, like, imagine, say it's a bank loan of £1,000. If you don't pay your debt on the due day, say on the you know, the beginning of the month or whatever it is that you've set up with them, after about 2 months, the bank sells that debt. So the £1,000 gets sold at a discount to a debt purchaser. So usually about 50% is the going rate for a relatively fresh bank debt that is not being paid. So the person who buys that debt, or the entity that buys that debt, now basically own your £1,000 debt, and they will ask you to pay the full amount plus the interest that was agreed. However, if you keep out of contact with them, after a while they will sell that debt on again, and this goes on and on at continual discount until the debt gets to about 6 years old. Then it's classified as a delinquent debt. It becomes a delinquent debt. And as it gets towards six, if there's been no contact between the creditor and debtor, the debt will be written off by law or by statute, and that's called statute barred. So as a debt becomes increasingly delinquent or distressed, the face value of the debt plunges. So, you know, towards 5 or 6 years old, you can buy up debt for 1 or 2% of its face value. And that's how we managed to procure £1.2 million worth of high interest debt for just under £20,000.
We needed it to make a kind of provocative action and kind of pierce public discourse in some way and kind of get it in the media and use kind of this cultural act as a, yeah, an explosion in people's minds almost. So that's why we were determined that we would kind of symbolically explode that debt in a golden transit, like debt in transit van, in front of Canary Wharf and the Docklands skyline. And it was really kind of, that was one of the hardest things to pull off, because as we discovered, kind of, we chose that skyline for its symbolism, and we called the action Big Bang 2 after Big Bang 1 in 1986, when Thatcher deregulated the financial markets. And it's kind of this moment at the beginning of neoliberalism. You know, we came under a lot of scrutiny for doing that, because it was like, you could go ahead with this if you were a commercial operation, but because of the message of this, we were trying to be stopped. And I suppose the whole point of it was we never saw this kind of debt write-off as a solution, as nor did strike debt. It was more, as they say, like a spark to kind of illuminate, or just to highlight as an act of economic education in itself, to just highlight the very existence of the secondary debt markets and the system that forces people into these kind of predatory debt traps. So it was never intended as a solution. It wasn't even really intended as a kind of helping out the people in debt, because we were very aware of this kind of narrative of, oh, the other, like the debtor, who, poor thing, you know, this kind of idea of it as poor relief. And really we wanted to highlight that it's a systemic issue, and the whole system needs changing, and all of the kind of moralizing around the debtor as this kind of sinner almost should be changed. So it was kind of a lightning rod into that way of arguing. In this time we've been kind of grieving over the loss of David Graeber and writing, and kind of rediscovering some of his writings around, like, the last 30 years being a kind of the construction of a huge apparatus of hopelessness. And I think that has infected, you know, many people through this time, that you feel like you can't make a difference. And yet I think that maybe what was contagious about the project was that, you know, you can see change happening or things, just those simple things, action of making and taking your place on the high street and that others join you and you soon kind of become a chorus of voices and standing up and demanding changes. So it was empowering for, you know, ourselves and for, I hope, for other people.
Thanks to Hilary Powell and Dan Edelstein from the Ho Street Central Bank. They have a feature documentary on the project coming out in spring 2021, and their book about the experience, Bank Job, is released on the 17th of September, published by Chelsea Green Publishing. Make sure to get yourself a copy. Next, we turn our attention to the Global South.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jane Clifton, back again for this session of the podcast, which is going to be looking at another really critical contemporary debt issue, and that's the public debt crisis that's been spreading across countries in the Global South over the course of the last decade. It's quite likely that at least some people listening to this podcast would have been active in the UK campaigning to tackle the last big debt crisis that hit countries in the Global South in the 80s and 90s. That debt crisis affected countries across Asia, Africa, and Latin America. It led to an enormous drain on public resources, such that some countries were paying more than 40% of their annual government revenue on debt servicing. And it led to what's referred to as a lost decade of development, with big hikes in poverty and in measures like maternal and child mortality. And a big global movement sprang up in response, initiated and led by campaigners in the Global South, and they built a really powerful campaign. Here in the UK, the campaign brought together faith groups with organisations like Oxfam, the trade unions, and also radical grassroots anti-capitalist activists. And together they pulled off some really amazing campaigning and activism, including the famous Hands Around the G8 action, where 80,000 people encircled the G8 meeting in Birmingham in 1998. That global campaign had a really big victory, so pushing world leaders to cancel £75 billion worth of debt for 35 developing countries between 2000 and 2015. And that enabled the countries that benefited from the debt cancellation to focus more on their domestic resources, on poverty alleviation, on public services like healthcare and education. And it tracked really quickly across to really concrete improvements in things like primary school participation in countries that benefited. But since 2008, we've once again seen a rise in debt levels in countries in the Global South. And now, unfortunately, we're pretty back to where we were before all that debt was cancelled. There are now 52 countries that are in debt crisis globally. That's up 20 in the last 2 years, and a further 63 countries that are at risk of debt crisis. So joining me to explore what's behind this new debt crisis, we're really lucky to have two prominent and long-standing thinkers and activists from the global debt movement. Lydie Naspil is an activist from the Philippines, working across economic, environmental, social, and gender justice issues at the national, regional, and global level. Yao Graham is coordinator of Third World Network Africa, which is a pan-African advocacy organization based in Accra, Ghana, which works for economic and social equity within Africa and for an equitable place for Africa in the global order. Why is it that we're back here? Why are so many Global South countries in debt crisis again? Lydie, let's start with you.
First of all, while we welcome what the gains that we had in the two major debt relief initiatives that the creditors put forward because of many years of campaigning on the part of debt movements, of course, the debt relief measures put forward, first of all, wasn't hardly enough, because it covered too few countries and too little of the overall debt. And secondly, it was really primarily geared towards some measure of immediate relief in terms of debt payments. But it actually was also primarily designed by the creditors to be able to clean the books of these countries so they can borrow again. I was in a panel of the representative with together with the representative of the IMF back in the early 2000s, and he very much explicitly acknowledged this, that they're helping these countries to clean up their books so that they can be, and he was proudly saying, so that they will be able to borrow again, especially borrow from financial markets and non-concessional loans. So there you have the history that many of these countries under debt distress now are actually, several of them were part of those that received debt relief in those two major debt relief initiatives. The other point I'd like to stress is, of course, the conception of a debt crisis is really mainly defined from the point of view of creditors. It's when the borrowers are no longer able to pay in full and on time. So if you're at risk of being in that position or are already in that position, that's when they say that you're in a debt crisis. I just want to emphasize that it doesn't mean there hasn't been any huge debt burdens for these years in between this debt relief period, because most countries have been dealing with staggering amounts of debt payments. But as long as they can pay on time, the creditors will say, oh, they're not in crisis. They are in sustainable debt levels because they're able to pay.
This all got to do really with the nature of the international economy. And the structural adjustment basically was interested in recreating the efficiency of that international regime for the benefits, you know, of international capital. So we've become bigger and, shall we say, more efficient producers of commodities. But efficiency not defined in terms of, you know, value for the country, but efficiency in terms of lowering the cost of production and allowing higher returns, you know, to foreign investors, together with a kind of regimes that allow these flows. If you look at doing business index that the World Bank does, what is this about? It's about liberalizing the regimes as a measure of a good economy.
And Lydia, you've campaigned a lot on the IMF as one of the kind of actors that plays this role of dishing out that kind of austerity medicine and liberalization medicine that Yao's talking about.
Yes, actually, the IMF has worked in tandem with the World Bank. So the IMF is on the fiscal and monetary policies, austerity measures. But the World Bank has also historically combined its lending with conditionalities like liberalization, trade liberalization, including current and capital accounts liberalization, what Yao was talking about. That's why even when we were campaigning in the late 1990s and in through the first decade of the 2000, we had been saying that the relief from debt cancellation should not just be used for social services. It should be used for governments to create the opportunities and the possibilities for shifting the economies in the South, for reorienting the economies in the South, not to produce for the world market, but to produce for its own people, and not for the wealth that it generates to be just spirited away outside of the country in various forms, including profit repatriation or even exporting of raw materials instead of finished products, but for us to keep the wealth inside the country. Unless you do that, if debt relief is being given even in more significant terms than the last two initiatives, what it's all going to do is to provide spending for immediate needs and no opportunity to reorient the economy, then we are not going to have a lasting solution for the debt problem.
Around 50%, as I understand it, of the private debts of developing countries are issued under UK law. Around 90% of the private debts of African countries. So we obviously have a really significant role to play in this. What do you think we can do from here in the UK to support these demands that you're talking about that are being put forward by campaigners in the Global South? What should we be pressuring our government to do?
So I think we need to essentialize these demands, and also with our better knowledge of which institutions are critical in the UK to put pressure on to identify those and so on. And there are some of the tactics of the old debt campaigning movement which have to be brought to bear. The combination of North-South, you know, kind of a shared engagement, cross-feeding into each other's domestic spaces, you know, identifying moments that we can work together, but also to underline the fact that this kind of appearance of a kind of a benign facilitation role, you know, of the United Kingdom and so on. It's definitely a misrepresentation. You know, the UK remains an important colonial power, you know, in particular ways in which it services, you know, international capital. As a country, it may no longer, the sun has set, you know, on the empire in that sense. But it's an important cog in the totality of the global empire of capital. And I think that is something that we need to keep in view.
Thanks once again to Sarah Jane Clifton, Yael Graham and Liddy Naspel for those international perspectives. As we have discussed, debt is a system and a cycle that is incredibly hard to break. Alex Macy gives us his story of gambling loans and how debt has affected his life.
Hi, I'm Alex Macy. I am the founder of Gamvisory.com, which is an organisation which specialises in gambling harms and risks. So I want to talk about debt, how debt played a part in my life, obviously as a product of gambling. And it kind of, to be honest, felt like I was in debt all of the time whilst I gambled, which was the majority of my life. I would be constantly in overdrafts and really not having any money. So, living that existence would be the same really as many people that suffer from, you know, poverty or are in extreme debt. So as I say, I was continually on the limit of my overdraft and other overdrafts throughout my life. And the worst period of my gambling was around early 2017, the latter part of 2016. I remember something like £35,000 going out of my account and a little bit lower coming back in due to the gambling just within a month, 1 month or 2 month period. And actually, it was literally after that period that I took two loans out of £5,000 each within a 24-hour period. And this was done really easily on the app, on the banking app. A few clicks of a button, excuse me, and it was transferred from, the bank to the gambling company and churned through the first £5,000 and then clicked the app again, the banking app again, and got another £5,000. You know, within minutes. And that was, you know, less than 24 hours later. Now, curiously, on occasions, the bank would ask me about some transactions and they would block them and ask me, you know, ring me up and ask me whether they were fraudulent. And I'd say, no, it's a gambling transaction. So they were obviously very well aware of, you know, my gambling history. And, you know, also each gambling transaction is coded. So the banks know exactly, you know, what you spend your money on. And I find it a little bit odd that there was no proper affordability checks or, you know, or recognition that, you know, I was clearly a vulnerable person at that point in time with my gambling. So, you know, the legacy of that debt was, you know, we're talking about a 24-hour period. The legacy was 18 months of having to pay that £10,000 back. And it obviously was a lot of money. I'd say 60-65% of my, you know, disposable income at the time. So it took a huge chunk, and it was, you know, a legacy for me that I had to deal with for the 18 months to pay that money back for a few clicks of a button. You know, I asked the bank and challenged them about this and asked for the data. For me, it was clearly a case of they were negligent, I believe, in lending me that money. That's really the long and short of it with my sort of exposure to debt. And really just to reiterate that I was kind of enslaved to debt via, you know, overdrafts throughout my life. And obviously it became a whole lot worse when I got those loans out. And as I say, the legacy of one day's gambling, you know, was felt for 18 months afterwards.
But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for.
The fallout from the 2008 financial crash can still be felt across the world, but the mechanisms by which it happened can seem very hard to grasp. For an explanation of how corporate debt works, and if a similar bubble could burst again, we turn to economist and writer Grace Blakely for a crash course.
Britain's big banks under sustained attack on the markets.
Selling has brought Bear Stearns, an investment bank, to its knees.
The American financial system is rocked to its foundation as top Wall Street institutions topple under a mountain of debt.
So the US and the UK both already had very high levels of corporate debt before the pandemic. In the US, this was particularly obvious. Corporate debt in the US had reached the highest levels that it had ever been. And a lot of people were talking about a corporate debt bubble in the US. In the UK, there was also problems. Andrew Bailey, who is now the governor of the Bank of England, had warned about corporate debt in the UK. It wasn't, you know, as high as it was before the financial crisis, but there was a lot of risk in the what's called the high yield corporate bond market. So basically that's risky corporate debt. And a lot of this debt in both the US and the UK was being securitized in a similar way as mortgage debt was securitized before the financial crisis into things called collateralized loan obligations, which, you know, if you've seen The Big Short, you'll be familiar with from the collateralized debt obligations. So there were, you know, various kind of pockets of risk in this market that were causing even regulators cause for concern. Now, this massive increase in corporate debt is down really to two things. So it's falling investment and productivity on the one hand, and low interest rates and quantitative easing on the other hand. So in the wake of the financial crisis, a lot of businesses were borrowing a lot just to stay afloat. And they were able to do that because interest rates are low. But as the recovery, in inverted commas, progresses, investment in fixed capital doesn't rise, even though corporate debt carries on rising. And what you see is that in certain parts of the corporate world, a lot of this borrowing is just going into share buybacks, dividends payouts, or actually increasing the M&A activity. So companies buying other companies or firms merging. And a lot of the time, this is big companies buying smaller companies. Now, obviously, at this point, you're getting more debt, but you're not getting more investment that's going to increase productivity and profits down the line, which is going to make it much harder to pay off that debt. And this is obviously part of a bigger problem that begins to emerge after the financial crisis of productivity stagnating in a way that, you know, hasn't been the case really in the history of modern capitalism. So this combination of rising debt and a stagnant real economy has had two other effects, or has been linked to two other phenomena, which is monopolization and zombification. So on the one hand, you've got a couple of firms that have basically been able to take advantage of low interest rates and of loose monetary policy. And they've been able to basically buy up other corporations in order to increase their monopoly power. And we know that rising monopoly power is associated with things like lower wages, rising inequality, you know, firms avoiding their taxes, etc. But then on the other hand, we have this phenomenon of zombie firms that can only afford to pay the interest on their lending. And they're called zombie firms because they're like the walking dead. You know, they should have gone under, they should have died at some point in the last 10 years. But because of, you know, they've been able to access very cheap debt, they haven't, and they've kind of continued. And that's obviously been a factor in exacerbating the productivity problem, because these firms really aren't doing much that's particularly useful and actually probably should have gone under. So then you get the pandemic, and the gap between the zombies and the monopolies widens to this chasm. The monopolies benefit massively from the cheap liquidity being pumped into financial markets by central banks and by interest rate cuts that, you know, allows them to do all sort of financial engineering to push up their share prices. And we're probably going to see, we're already starting to see some mergers and acquisitions now. We're probably going to see a lot more of that happening as the big guys are able to benefit from this low interest rate environment to take out more debt and use that to increase their power. But the zombies, you know, many of those have gone under. In fact, many healthy firms have gone under or will go under because of the depressed economic environment. Others have been saved through government bailouts, but it's not really clear what's going to happen over the long run. In the UK, the government's lent this money or supported lending to all these businesses. But the banks who are administering the loans have said that maybe up to half of businesses receiving those loans are going to default. And the government hasn't done anything about that yet. So, you know, we could yet see this big collapse, which would obviously threaten the stability of the financial system if lots of corporations default on their loans at the same time. And I think this brings to light an observation that was made by the brilliant anthropologist David Graeber, who sadly died last week, who always used to say that debt was about power. Debt was a power relation. And for the wealthy, for those with a lot of assets, you know, you could use debt to actually increase your power. But for so many other people, it is like a kind of chain around your ankle. So, you know, we've had years of loose monetary policy combined with tight fiscal policy, and it's created this massive gap between, you know, the real economy, between productivity, wages been stagnant, and these roaring asset prices and the very easy debt that has primarily benefited people and companies that already have lots of assets. It's just, you know, created this big problem. We've almost got kind of two economies, and you can see this with the stock market in the US, say, versus the unemployment crisis. So we may have this combination of loose monetary policy and tight fiscal policy continuing into the future. And for shareholders in Apple and Google, that might sound like good news. But for everyone else, it just means higher inequality and a more fragile economy.
As we approach the end of the show, we linked up with Ava from Jubilee Debt Campaign to talk with Dr. Jonna Montgomery, council member of the Progressive Economy Forum, about the specific challenges of household debt and potential radical strategies for a less indebted future.
We're going to talk about another aspect of kind of debt crisis now, which is personal debt crises or the household debt crisis in the UK. I feel like this is an issue that just kind of really just doesn't get enough airtime or kind of enough people really know about as a kind of really key issue and a really key problem in terms of inequality in the UK. So personal debt, that sort of debt that people have from maybe high cost loans that they've taken out, or even just kind of mounting debt from utility bills, from consumer credit, that sort of thing. Jonna, do you want to talk a little bit about the problem and also, I guess, what we've seen recently, and then we'll move on to maybe what we need to do about that?
Well, a lot of politicians are very comfortable talking about the overall problem of too much public debt. The idea that private debt is a problem has not really gained a lot of traction. It's sort of like public debt is a public issue, but private debt is a private problem. And that's really problematic, especially in this day and age with COVID. And the economic shockwave that's coming as a result of it. Because as we've seen, you know, as the pandemic made clear, is that the economy is really just people. And when we put this kind of stress on people and disrupt their daily lives through measures like staying at home or closing down businesses, or the economy feels that, right? It begins to contract people, and then there's knock-on effects. Then people lose their jobs, spending gets sucked out of the economy. So as much as possible, we should really begin to think that people's private debt problems have much bigger consequences for the entire economy. So that's the kind of where I would start to say that, well, it's a long-standing problem. We have this mountain of debt sitting on the economy, again, much higher than it was in 2008, having long surpassed the peak. And then this economic shock comes really out of nowhere, and now we're dealing with it. Now, why is this, you know, an issue? Well, firstly, when we look at the emergency measures that have been put in place to deal with the economic shockwave of COVID-19, which is to dramatically slash interest rates and to pump all kinds of liquidity, or basically money via government debt, into markets, households have not benefited from that. So there hasn't been a reduction in the amount of interest or the interest rates that households pay on their debt. So nobody's got a note saying, the Bank of England has drastically reduced interest rates. Your credit card's going to go from 19.5% to 0.5% like the bigger corporations enjoy. On the contrary, interest rates for households on consumer debt have remained exceedingly high. And they haven't been, that cheap interest has not been passed on to the average borrower. So this means that people are still expected to pay very high interest rates at a time when we know that there's all, you know, growing unemployment, you know, furlough is 80% of wages. So we know there's people have had real shocks in their income side. And yet we're not giving them the same benefit or the same access to emergency monetary measures on their loans that the banks themselves enjoy and other types of firms and so on had access to.
I wonder if there's anything else we can say also about the issues of kind of council tax debt and rent debt, because I know those are kind of very pressing issues for people at the moment. And, you know, one of the issues with council tax debt is you sort of miss a payment, and then I think you have to pay for you know, almost the whole year. And it's also one of the issues I think that is people feel the most pressure from in terms of bailiffs coming around. And obviously bailiffs activity resumed last month. So I guess just in terms of the debts that people are you know, really pressing on people at the moment, there's a few different areas where some more immediate attention is needed.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point you make, because there are two different types of priority payment debts, right? You have your debts that you owe to the bank and to your lenders, your consumer credit agreements. And you're absolutely right that the FCA nominated those for debt deferral. But then we have our priority payments. These are the, or priority debts. These are the ones that are owed, for example, to the council as a form of tax or to a utility company, some of which, you know, have very specific credit terms. And these, as you rightly point out, are very, very problematic in terms of what material threat they make to the household for non-payment. So, you know, arrears in your council tax, again, will bring the bailiffs around. Arrears in your utility bills will lead to your utilities being cut off. And these create real material stresses on households in a way that, for example, if you didn't pay your credit card, you would just, you know, receive nuisance calls and so on. But it would take a much longer period of time for those non-priority creditors to chase you down for payment, and a much like a different, more light touch approach to discharging it. Whereas, unfortunately, councils who are, you know, local authorities who have been under huge pressure in their own financial balance sheets have resorted to using bailiffs and very strong arm tactics to collect these taxes from households in arrears, which really, again, if we think about how we can use modes of debt relief, again, central government can very easily relieve those council tax debts, you know, from as a transfer from central governments to local authorities to forgive those debts to those really problem households. We've seen that, for example, in Croatia with the Fresh Start program, where there was a coordinated effort between governments and utilities in order to relieve, you know, those households that are most adversely affected by arrears, to give them a fresh start. The idea of forgiving council tax arrears for the period of 2020, at least, would be a very small amount of money and would provide great relief to the most vulnerable households, but also to those local authorities under pressure.
Yeah, and I think there are lots of different very useful measures that can be introduced. And, you know, in the past few months, we've seen these huge kind of economic packages and policies being brought into existence, and things that we couldn't have even have imagined happening before, like the, you know, the furlough scheme and, you know, a lot of the other things. And this stuff in comparison is not huge. It's not outside of the realms of possibility at all. But what's, you know, what's needed is the kind of the will to make it happen. And I think for this issue to really kind of be pushed up the agenda more, because one of the things that I'm always surprised by is just actually how little people know about it, how it's almost not out there as much in the consciousness as a kind of key issue in this sort of area. So I think that's partly why it really needs people to, you know, start campaigning, to kind of join, you know, start kind of thinking about and taking action on this issue. The other thing I was just going to add that if people are looking for debt advice, the sort of Step Change or the Citizens Advice Bureau are great places to go for debt advice. And yeah, we sort of need to see more action and kind of more pressure on the issue, essentially.
Well, I think if we take COVID-19 and this idea of a pandemic and the body politic or the body economic itself being sick and being struck down by illness, that really private debt is our pre-existing condition. You know, it is this debt dependency that the UK growth model has relied on for 20 years, 25 years. So it went into this pandemic hugely over-indebted. Households are over-indebted. Firms are over-indebted. You know, the government has hugely expanded its borrowing, as is the central bank, post-2008 in order to keep, you know, the economy revived. And now this pandemic has hit, and this debt as a pre-existing condition will continue to be what will hold a recovery back. So we need to think about debt relief as part of the treatment, not just for the economic shock of COVID-19 and the illness that that is creating, you know, the kind of systemic seizure that's taking, but also as part of a long-term recovery to health, that we're not going back to these the same dependency on debt to drive consumption, to pay, you know, for people to pay for their everyday life, you know, just their cash flow and topping up their shortfalls in income with debt. So we need to think about debt relief as part of this long-term recovery, not just from COVID, but a revival of an economic model that is not dependent on debt to keep the whole system going. So, you know, there's a very positive role that debt relief can play in this, not just to relieve the symptoms of economic shock and harm, but rather to also renew and revive the economy to be better, basically, and more flexible and more prosperous in the sense that it can deal with things like inequality. It can cope with shocks. We're not having a major financial crisis every 7 to 8 years. You know, that cycle, the boom, bust, bailout, austerity, doom loop that we've been stuck in, that debt drives, we have an opportunity through COVID to learn from our mistakes and to design a new economic policy that, you know, again, a progressive economic policy that can address these issues and, you know, consign them to the past. And I think that's a real vision of hope.
Finally, here's Ben Beach, arts coordinator of TWT 2019, with a tribute to David Graeber.
No conversation around debt would be complete without discussing the work of David Graeber, a friend and comrade to many in the movement, who tragically died earlier this month in Venice. David's seminal work, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, traces the origins of debt and the modern financial system as first an extension of military conquest and then of colonial domination, a system that continues to this day in subjugating the global south and the international working class to the system of global finance. Yet what perhaps makes debt so powerful is his optimistic call that we can build a society based on something better than organised violence. Stemming from David's experiences in the Alter Globalisation movement and later Occupy Wall Street, debt recounts how the movements helped to reshape the relationship between the Global South and the International Monetary Fund. Perhaps what's so intriguing about David's politics is the joyful and ludic nature of his calls for a society based not just on a more equitable distribution of resources, but also on joy and in taking pleasure in the everyday life and mystery of the world that surrounds us. I first met David in 2010 as part of the student movement. We saw at the time that the moves to shackle us with unpayable debts of over £9,000 a year would rob us of our capability to participate in the future society that we would want to see, shackling us instead to a system of neoliberalism that, as we have seen over 10 years of austerity, has ground the working class of this country into the ground. Here's David talking at the Bafla Foundation, San Francisco in 2013, saying just this, how student debt immiserates us, not just socially or economically, but also culturally and intellectually.
I was just talking with Laura Nader earlier about student loans as sort of destroying the imagination of youth. You know, if there's a way of a society committing mass suicide, you know, what better way than to take all the youngest, most energetic, creative, joyous people in your society and saddle them with like $50,000 worth of debt so they have to be slaves. I mean, you know, there goes your music, there goes your culture, there goes, you know, everything new that would pop out. And in a way, you know, this is what's happened to our society. We're a society that, you know, has lost any ability to incorporate like the sort of interesting, creative, and eccentric people. All intellectual producers, if you're a scholar, if you're an intellectual, if you're an artist or a investigative journalist even, you have to work for a university. But a university has become these sort of professionalized, conformist places where you can't actually have fun. So in a way, in that way, what the Baffler is trying to do, to actually have fun with it and be smart and creative, and what even something like Occupy is trying to do, open up the human imagination, which has been killed politically, is kind of the same thing. It's part of a much broader project to create spaces outside of these disciplinary mechanisms that have been created to confine us. There's been a war on the human imagination and the idea that the imagination can be a force in history for the last 30 years, and it's been far too successful, and it's high time we start fighting back by defiantly having fun in ways that will actually make the world a better place.
You've been listening to TWT FM, a podcast from The World Transformed. If you could subscribe to the podcast and leave a review, that would really help other people discover the show. Right now at TWT, we're in the middle of our annual festival, And this year, for the first time ever, it's happening online and throughout the whole of September. For the final 2 weeks of the festival, we've planned workshops, panels, debates, a collective listening session, strategy games, a pub quiz, and much, much more. So what are you waiting for? Head on over to theworldtransformed.org to register for a festival pass and book onto your favourite sessions. But be quick, many have limited capacity and are filling up fast. And finally, if you've enjoyed this episode of TWT-FM and would like us to continue producing the podcast after the TWT20 festival is over, please consider supporting us at theworldtransformed.org/support. A regular donation equal to the cost of an hour's wage per month would really go a long way to help us continue creating important political education content like TWT-FM all year round. That's theworldtransformed.org/support. See you next Sunday for the next episode of TWT-FM, where we'll explore the topic of homelessness.